The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
And get started, and people can just join us as they come in. My name is Amrita Vasan. I live and work in Washington, D.C., and I work with an organization called the Asian Pacific Islander Domestic Violence Resource Project. And I'm really excited to be here for this session, which is called Creating Spaces, Gender, Race, and Sexuality. So if you were planning on being on another one, this would be the time you would walk out. Just wanted to request everyone to perhaps put their, or not perhaps, but put their cell phones on vibrate or silent, just so that we can all be present and really take from this conversation. And the way the panel is going to work is that we prepared some questions that we thought would be interesting to speak to this topic, and we'll go ahead and talk with the panelists, and after that there'll be a section where you can ask your questions, and we'll have a Q&A, and then we will wrap up. So I'm really glad you all are here. Welcome. And with us today we have Uruj, who's in the center. Uruj has had 13 years of experience organizing within LGBTQI communities of color, especially addressing issues of Islamophobia, violence, sexism, transphobia, and ageism. Uruj is currently a board member of the Al Fatiha Foundation, and in her day job, she's the program manager for the Youth of Color Initiative at Advocates for Youth here in D.C. Welcome, Uruj. And then to Uruj's left, we have Manisha Kelkar. Manisha is the director of Manavi, a New Jersey-based organization committed to ending violence against women, serving battered women who trace their roots to Bangladesh, India, Nepal, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. Welcome, Manisha. And then to my left is Amita Swadeen. Amita is dedicated to creating learning opportunities that help people understand intersections between internalized, interpersonal, and institutional oppression and violence, and empower them to challenge the norms and systems that perpetuate such conditions. Okay. Over the past 10 years, she's worked as a program manager, an educator, youth organizer, and consultant at nonprofits, public schools, and universities in New York City. Welcome, Amita. To start off, a lot of the conversation we had in preparing for this session was talking about the intersectionality between gender, race, and sexuality, and what does that mean in terms of identity, but also in terms of the lenses we use to analyze what's going on around us and how that comes forth in our social justice work. So to start with, I wanted to invite you all to talk about what does that mean for you, like the intersectionalities of identities or experiences, and if you can talk about how you see that in your work or in your lives, in terms of the connections you see in terms of your own identity or perhaps the populations that you work with.
So, hi, everyone. So as you heard from my bio, my work has not necessarily been in the South Asian-specific context, although I was part of the Youth Solidarity Summer Collective for 10 years, which is a South Asian youth organizing project. My day jobs have been more doing youth organizing work in communities of color, mostly Black and Latino, and in schools, public schools in New York City. So as a queer woman who is South Asian, who is the daughter of immigrants, who is a survivor of violence, who is also a youth educator doing organizing work in other communities of color, I find panel topics like this, the one that this is titled, to be problematic. And I'm just going to start off the conversation that way because we've already all talked about it. But when Deepa invited me to be on this panel, it's called Carving Out Spaces. And that's just not a reflection of what my work has been. My work has been more applying a lens of social justice to many different movements. And I think regardless of who you are in this world or in this room even, the conversation that we're about to have, I think, is one that's applicable to everyone, whether you're straight or queer, whether you're first generation or second generation, et cetera. I think what we're here to pose questions about is what does it mean to work for social justice and whose identities are informing that conversation. And for me, for example, let me just give some concrete examples. My work has mostly been around violence along institutional levels, so everything with working from young people of color who are incarcerated at higher rates or recruited by the military at higher rates than other young people. Also working with survivors of domestic violence or sexual assault, many of whom are immigrant women or who are queer people, transgendered people, whose stories are not necessarily represented by mainstream organizations. And thinking about what happens when we don't apply a lens of intersectionality in our organizing work, right? So if we have, let's say, a domestic violence organization that is working in the South Asian community, and it doesn't also think about violence against queer people or violence against transgendered people, we may get into a situation where we're creating a solid base for a particular experience of intimate partner violence, let's say first-generation immigrant South Asian women, but a person who is first-generation immigrant but happens to be queer and date people from same gender, and let's say they have intimate partner violence in their relationship, they may not feel safe because of homophobia in an organization going to that particular organization. And I'm not thinking about one specifically, just in case anyone is wondering, but just more applying the critique, right? That we have to be cognizant of the kind of spaces we're creating when we work in organizations that I know many of us in this room do. Similarly, if we're working in the immigrant rights movement, and we're working against deportation and detention. And I saw this happen on the ground in New York a lot after 9/11, and that's how I got into education work in schools there. We had young people of color, mostly black or African American, Caribbean, in Brooklyn, where I live, committing hate crimes against South Asian young people and South Asian elders, I mean my peers as well. One of my friends actually in DC was attacked by three young black men, right? And we hear this phrase in the media so often, right? This faceless young black men committing crimes. And I think too many of us were immediately forming South Asian organizations against hate crimes and wondering why us or feeling attacked and not asking ourselves the questions of, well, did we stand up and protest against the prison industrial complex before deportations and detention started being about us? Did we stand up and go to police brutality rallies before South Asians were the ones being attacked? You know, and some of us did, but I'd like to posit that maybe all of us need to be thinking that way all the time. And it's not until those true bonds of solidarity are built are we going to really be working in a movement for social justice. So just to start us off, I'd like to reframe this conversation about maybe what those of us who inhabit queer spaces or think through those lenses because of our own complicated identities, what we can contribute to the conversation about what it means to work for social justice.
Yeah, I definitely want to echo what Amita was saying around sort of, you know, it's not, we're not working in silos, our identities are sort of inform each other. So just giving an example of, you know, I consider myself a 1.5 immigrant person, so I came to this country when I was 17. So, you know, growing up in Pakistan, I didn't necessarily identify at all as a person of color and didn't really know what that meant until I came here. And it wasn't until I went to a really white mainstream school in the Midwest, and it wasn't until I came out as queer that I really started realizing what it meant for me to be a person of color. So it's really through that route that I started experiencing, you know, like I didn't identify with sort of the white mainstream, you know, gay community, not even queer, because I think of, you know, gay versus queer, very different identities and very different concepts, queer being a little, you know, more politicized, more around looking at, you know, not just the silos, but really how, you know, that identity is part of other, you know, intersections. And so that's one way that for me it was together. It was coming out together as a person of color as well as a queer person. And so for me those were intersections that came together. Similarly, you know, as Amita was also mentioning, post 9/11, you know, as a Muslim person, I started really thinking of myself. I'm secular, I'm a cultural Muslim, and so I never really thought of, you know, what it meant to occupy that space. And, you know, what I started realizing was that post 9/11, it was sort of this, like, what kind of Muslim, you know, what kind of Muslim is it, or perceived Muslim that gets attacked or is experiencing violence, and, you know, the South Asian and Arab communities, and also sort of, you know, kind of like the commingling also from the media and sort of the perception of a Muslim identity, and for me it becomes sort of a racialized identity. So I think in those ways that, you know, it's not really easy to separate out those things, and how as our work continues we need to be mindful of those integrations and how folks present themselves in, you know, all of those multiple ways and looking at those intersections.
Hi, everyone. I think it's important, like the rest of folks on the panel have done, to really sort of have this full disclosure about our own personal backgrounds, because that really helps the discussion and frame everything. And so from the way I came to this country was as a student, and a student from India, and I came as a heterosexual woman from a privileged, well-educated, middle-class background who had the mainstream thinking, right? Because I grew up as mainstream in India. And so coming here, for the longest number of years, I thought of myself as mainstream. I was not a woman of color. I was not an immigrant. I was mainstream. Because you bring with you a thought process, and you don't really question that, especially if you go to school to study something as quantitative as economics. It's not thrown at you at all. So till one day, and again, this is where I was, not at the College of Law, but American University is where I got my graduate degree in economics. But my part-time job was in the Washington College of Law, shelving books and doing computer work, data entry, and so on. And it was right here where I had my first big shock of how I'm not mainstream, when five of us student workers, I was the only immigrant student worker, the others were four other white people. We were all sitting there doing the same work. We were putting loose sheets of paper into big manuals and all the sort of work that student workers do. And the four of them, and we were all talking, and I didn't realize then that they were talking. I was just adding things, but no one was really listening. And the shock was that all of them agreed to buy pizza for lunch, and no one asked me. And I kept thinking, I was at my computer, I was entering this data, and I'm hearing, cheese, I want mushroom, I want this. And we're all sitting in clear view of each other. It's not like I was hidden somewhere. But I'm sitting there, and I'm typing things, and I said, I don't like mushroom. No one said anything. No one acknowledged it. It's not that anyone was being overtly racist or nasty or unpleasant or obnoxious. I was just invisible. I was completely invisible. And, it's one of those bolt of lightning moments. And so ever since then, I've been working through the issues of being a woman of color, a person of color, an immigrant, a heterosexual person, which itself a heterosexual woman, which also comes with its own oppressions, gender oppressions of patriarchy and secondary status and all of that. And so all of that does go to form or give a perspective to the work I do at Manavi in bringing intersectionality into all of our work.
So my question, like, to further the conversation along would be, like, we're talking about, like, there's this nebulous space between, then what does intersectionality really mean, right? Like, if it isn't, like, this identity-based, like, soul, like, you know, this is what I'm going to go with, what is intersectionality, like, what could it really mean? What could it really come? And you started to talk about this a little bit in your introduction, Amita, but if you could, like, just lead us a little bit forward in that conversation of what does that look like in terms of doing social justice work.
Sure. Well, and since this conversation is titled, you know, Carving Out Spaces with, I think, Gender and Sexuality, right, I'll tell you about a curriculum that I just wrote. Are you guys familiar with NAPOF, the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum? It's a national organization, a pan-Asian organization that works for gender justice. And they recently got hired or invited by APIP. It's all these acronyms in our nonprofit world, right? It's the Asian Americans Pacific Islanders in Philanthropy, I think is what it's called. They got a grant from the Ford Foundation to put together a toolkit for Asian American identity-based nonprofits nationwide. And NAPOF's part of the toolkit was supposed to be on gender equity and gender justice. And I know the executive director for a long time. She ended up bringing me in to write the curriculum. We collaborated on it. So I've been doing a lot of thinking about what it means to apply a lens of gender justice analysis. And for me, it again, I think it's important if we're working in, you know, I'm not saying that it's wrong to come to the work of social justice through an identity-based route. I mean, I, like I said, I was an organizer of YSS for 10 years. It is a South Asian
radical or progressive youth space, right? But what is the value for those of us that do work in identity-based or identity-identified spaces to think through intersectionality? If you were to have a toolkit like this gender justice one, the purpose of it is to run trainings internally for your staff to make sure that all staff members in these Asian American organizations can apply an intersectional lens, right? And to understand why this is important, I'll bring up an example from the last panel that I was on. I went to Subhash's panel, Subhash and Priya, on immigration reform. And they showed a video about an HIV-positive gay Pakistani man who has been living in the United States for somewhere between 20 and 30 years legally, green card holder, right, who was who got into an altercation with someone in the Bronx and was then detained for about a year, I believe, in a detention facility. And when he went to get medical care, his doctor was South Asian. And his doctor was also very homophobic and also very HIV-positive phobic. And so that, to me, is a classic example of why all of us doing work in the South Asian community need to understand homophobia, need to understand transphobia, transgender phobia, need to understand sexism, and need to understand the kinds of violence that all of those oppressions can result in, right? Whether it be relegating or sentencing an HIV-positive queer man to a year in detention because one does not have that analysis as a service provider, whether it means that queer people who are in domestic violence situations, right, cannot go and access domestic violence services from within the South Asian community, which may be the place that they want to go first because they're immigrants, right, and that's where they feel safest. These are important questions to be asking ourselves. So I think it means that we need to do these kind of trainings within our organizations using the toolkit that NAPOF has put forward, or bringing in trainers, you know, who do this kind of social justice work, making sure that we have these conversations with our members, right? So for those of us working with young people or with first-generation immigrants, to make sure that we integrate social justice education into the work before we go out and do campaign work, right? Just to make sure that we're not continuing these oppressions. And I think that that is what it means to really have solidarity and to work with justice, to create an organization. Any South Asian organization, any immigrant rights organization, should be a place that is also not homophobic, that more than being not homophobic, puts out policy statements or membership statements in your materials saying we are against homophobia, we are against transphobia, we are against intimate partner violence, we are against sexual assault, even if you're an immigrant rights organization, right? That those of us who inhabit identities that cross all of those spaces, we don't ever sit down and choose, today I'm a queer person, but tomorrow when I go to the immigrant rights rally, I'm only going to be a daughter of immigrants, right? That identity is within us. So we need to know that we are going into spaces that are safe and understand the multiple oppressions that we face. Right, and that's the challenge that I would put forth, that that's what it means on the ground in a concrete way to use this lens of analysis in our work.
And yeah, and I think similarly for me, intersectionality is not necessarily an absence of identity, but it's really about integrating those identities and really looking at the global analysis and looking at the geopolitical analysis, looking at what's happening with communities around you. So I have a really good example. I was on the board of Push DC, which is the local GLBT South Asian organization, a few years ago, and that's around the time that all the immigration stuff was coming up. And the board, even though you would think that it would be a progressive board, was not, and they were not on board about signing on to advocate on behalf of immigrants and to advocate on behalf of immigrant rights. And I was just really shocked by that. I was like, how can this be? And, you know, but they came from a very conservative sort of political background. And so this happens constantly where, you know, it happened in Chicago with the South Asian women's organization, queer women's organization there, where, you know, folks are not necessarily building solidarity to other communities of color. Folks are not really getting how they need to sort of build those connections. And so there's a lot of stuff that comes up. And, you know, at this point, I'm sort of, I believe that it's about a progressive agenda, and it's not about an identity-based agenda in that way, that, you know, folks that are, you know, on the spectrum of sexual orientation, gender identity can come together, but it's about a progressive value. It's about having solidarity and hold each other accountable. So that's sort of where I think now I've sort of led all of those organizing that I did around identity has made me believe that at this point it's more about a different kind of agenda, a social justice agenda.
I'd like to frame intersectionality analysis in a slightly non-standard way. I don't know if anyone's ever done that, but my background is in economics. And for any of you who have had the opportunity or the misfortune of studying any economics at all, you might be familiar with the term ceteris paribus, which means all other things being equal or all other things being constant. So economists are always attempting to develop very cut and dried models of behavior, individual behavior actually, based on examining one thing at a time. So let's assume that income is not a factor. Let's assume that social differences are not a factor. Let's assume that, etc. So you assume away all differences in a population, making it seem like the population is homogenous, which it never is, never ever is. and then based on those assumptions, you develop a theory and you forecast. And guess what? All the wonderful forecasting on Wall Street certainly hasn't gone anywhere. Why? Because you're forecasting based on a model that's not real. And of course, a lot of financial analysts are going to pick on this because modeling has become, they will say, very, very technically superior and can incorporate a lot of things. But anyway, what I'm trying to say here is that a lot of thinking is done along the lines of ceteris paribus. Let's not cloud the issue with seven different things. Let's focus on one thing at a time. It does give you clarity of thought as long as you understand that once you've had that clarity of thought, you then bring everything back in that you assumed away. You can't assume away things. You can hold them constant for a while to get some clarity of thought, but bring them back all in. And once you bring it all back in, then it becomes a nice intersectional model of actual social behavior. So that's the way I like to see social justice work in terms of not ceteris paribus.
So to kind of narrow in on looking at intersectionality, looking at this kind of framework, but then is there any value, and what's that value of having lenses that are based on gender, based on race, based on sexuality, right? And particularly to you, Manavi, to you, Manisha, at Manavi, I have this question. Like, working at a domestic violence organization here in Washington, D.C., what we have found is that even though, like, we are, you know, at all the queer events and, you know, we have queer staff and we do anti-homophobia trainings and things like that, that because the South Asian community in the D.C. area is not located in, like, one little geographical neighborhood, that it's very hard for us to do anti-violence work in the community without doing anti-homophobia work. Mm-hmm. Or beyond that, anti-transphobia work, because there's a huge issue in terms of trans folks of color, and particularly South Asian immigrant, not being able to get into shelters and things like that. So I was just trying to see, like, what experiences you've had in your anti-violence work of being able to engage the South Asian community in terms of these broader issues, if you're not taking that identity-based route. So in terms of intersectionality, if you had examples of something that might have worked, or like how Manavi struggles with that or approaches that.
I wish I could give you an instances of how that might have worked. Unfortunately, I have only instances of how it has not worked, not for want of trying. So we have always tried to do our work. I mean, intersectionality is like the basis of our philosophy. But it's one thing to have a philosophy and quite another to create a space where our entire membership and the whole community sees that intersectionality as a viable thing. So, well, in the past, we've had very good working relationships with SALGA and other things. And so, you know, those are a few practical examples of how things have worked out. But a couple of different things. Whenever we bring up issues of same-sex violence within our community, the question that is asked to us, sometimes with board members, sometimes with volunteers, is, do you have instances of same-sex violence in the work you do? So the assumption is Are there women coming to us for help? Or is this something you're imagining or dreaming up? Now, but which is the cause and which is the effect, right? Is it, and so the answer is no, we don't have too many instances of women who call and say that they're experiencing same-sex violence, but is that because they don't feel safe in calling us? Or is that because, leave alone safe, maybe they don't even think this is the right place to call? And so we have in the past made a lot of effort to be in spaces like this and talk about issues like this and so on and hope that women will call. But it's still the truth. This is a lot of DV organizations, and we call ourselves not DV, but violence against women of all types. But still, a lot of violence against women, anti-violence organizations attempt, but are still seen as primarily, what did you call it, immigrant, no, first-generation immigrant. I think one of you said, yeah. Right, first-generation immigrant, heterosexual, and so on. And that is so because our community is still enormously homophobic. It's still, in casual conversations socially, I still hear people who I don't expect to be talking like this or even thinking like this say things like, we have to make sure our children don't become gay. So it's still very, very much a part of our community. And so in order to do community work, you know, so we can do work like this in panels where staff and board is all on board with everything, but the challenge of going into the community and actually getting some resonance from the community has been, I think, one of the biggest failures.
Can I respond to that? So I think that's a valid concern, and I certainly know that, you know, I've volunteered with Sucky for many years, and I certainly know that they have also faced similar challenges, and it's not for want of their politics being in the right place, right? We're talking about a skill set. Doing this social justice education is a skill, and I just want to say, though, like, although it's difficult, it certainly has been possible. I mean, as an educator, I haven't worked specifically only with South Asian youth, but, you know, I have done trainings with youth at SIA throughout the years, and certainly because I've worked in New York City public schools, there are always South Asian kids in the classroom in Brooklyn neighborhoods, you know. I think, so I've worked in Canarsie High School, Bushwick High School, and Prospect Heights High School. I don't know if there's any Brooklyn folks in the audience, but Brooklyn, yeah. So those are all neighborhoods with high populations of Caribbean youth. And if you know anything about Caribbean culture, particularly in the diaspora, it's incredibly homophobic. I mean, on par, if not more overtly so, than South Asian diaspora culture. I ran a group called Human Rights Activist Project through Global Kids, which is an organization I worked for 4 years in New York. And the mission of HRAP, Human Rights Activist Project, was to take young people in the schools, it's an open project, anyone can join, and just to give them a place to be after school and to start talking to them about human rights as a framework and ask them to select a campaign topic for the year, and then they get to design an action around that campaign topic. So I ended up 1 year with 20 young people, give or take, all Black, either African American or Caribbean. Two of them ended up coming out through the process of the year as queer. I was not out to the young people because I felt like, as an educator, you probably get more people to listen to you if they're coming from a homophobic place once they've built a relationship with you. So it was an ideological position I took to not be out to them. But the rest of the youth were straight identified, and some of them were openly, virulently homophobic in the beginning of the year. And through a process of weekly workshops with them, we ended up selecting the topic of youth homelessness as something they wanted to work on. Now, in New York City and in many, many urban areas in the United States, the most vulnerable population for homelessness is actually LGBT youth of color, because our communities tend to be incredibly homophobic. And often, when young people are outed to their families or come out to their families, they're kicked out of their homes. And, you know, it's not... The shelter system, for many, many reasons, is not a safe place for them, often because shelters are not LGBT specific for young people, and so their staff may not be trained. I mean, again, this talks about why intersectionality is important, regardless of the work we're doing, right? If we're running a shelter and we don't train our workers on how to not be homophobic, how to not be transphobic, and more than anything, how to practice being an ally, and to me, that's what this conversation is really about, right? Once you have the lens in place, it's one thing to do the thinking. What does it mean to do the work, right? So if you haven't trained your staff on how to provide those services in a way that puts the rights of the most vulnerable people first, you're going to end up with young people being beaten up in shelters and being jumped because they're gender queer, right? Because they look different than what their gender expression is, or their bodies are different than what their gender expression is. So you end up with a bunch of queer kids who are getting beaten up in shelters, right? I mean, so they end up on the streets. Anyway, through a process of political education with my young people who have selected homelessness as a topic, we do experiential workshops once a week, to the point where they finally start to understand what homophobia means, who the homeless young people in New York City are. The campaign culminated by June. Again, 18 very straight, beginning school year kind of homophobic young people doing street theater on the Christopher Street Pier, which is where, you know, most of the queer homeless young people hang out in New York City, getting petitions signed on behalf of FIERCE, which is an advocacy organization in New York run by young, queer, at-risk of homeless youth of color in New York City, right? Youth from Canarsie who have never been to the Christopher Street Pier before, collecting petition signatures, asking the city to build a youth drop-in shelter for the youth who are at risk. So I just want to give that as an example of positive solidarity and to say that, you know, it didn't happen overnight. That was work that was done with weekly political education workshops over the course of a school year. But it did happen, and it didn't take me coming out to them to do it, right? It took me educating them about what human rights means and starting to see the links between their own oppressions and the oppression that queer people face every day, or that people who go through violence face every day. And this is something that we can adapt in our work with our members. And it, you know, it's an investment in perhaps bringing in the right trainers or adapting the right curriculum. But the first step is to train your staff and your board members, you know, in this work.
Thank you for that. I think that's like a really remarkable example of how things are possible. My question to kind of get your response, Uruj, to what Amita just said, Alpha Thea being an organization that's not, does not have a staff, does not have a board, right? Because it seems like what is needed is like the skill building and training to get people there, to build that analysis, and the actions will come forth from it, if I'm understanding you right. But like organizations like Alpha Thea or Kush DC, or like, you know, a lot of us are involved in like collectives or smaller groups that are not necessarily non-profits or staff-based organizations. So I remember like when we were preparing and we were talking about what we were, you know, what we wanted to present at the panel, you talked about coming out as Muslim, right, amongst like mainstream queer community. So my question to you is like within Alpha Thea, like what do those conversations look like? How are you approaching, or I know like Alpha Thea is fairly young, but embodying the lessons learned from that horrible thing that happened at Kush DC, where like people didn't want to like show solidarity with the immigration rights movement, right? So how are you embodying that, given that it's in some ways an organization that's come together based on identity, right?
Yeah, so a little bit about Alpha Thea. Alpha Thea has been around for about 10 years, and it really started out of, it was such an interesting way it started that Faisal Alam, who's the founder of Alpha Thea, young Pakistani man at the time, and he was really, involved with this Muslim Student Association. He was very involved with the Muslim community, and just really felt extremely isolated. And so what he did was he sent out this email. And the way he did it was that, he sent it out to MSAs and other folks he knew, and he's like, can you believe that this is a queer Muslim, you know, organization that just started? And, you know, he just forwarded it as if he didn't know anything about it. And he set up this listserv. And so he said within minutes, that people started wanting to join the listserv. And at this point, it's been 10 years, the listserv is about 5,000-6,000 folks from around the world. And so clearly, you know, there's a need for, you know, for it, but it's also, it comes out of intense isolation. It comes out of, you know, even now we meet folks who are like, I thought I was the only one. And so part of the work we do is to really, you know, and as we know with young people, GLBT young people in general, that, you know, there's intense isolation for them. So part of the work we do is to kind of reduce that isolation. And so we try to work from both things. We try to acknowledge that there is, you know, Islamophobia in mainstream mainstream queer community, and especially I think since 9/11 has been increased. So for example, we were a few years ago, we've done some solidarity work with Khush DC because we, you know, obviously there's a lot of intersections, and so we were marching with Khush DC at Pride, and when, as we were passing by the announcement booth, the person is like, oh look, Al-Fatiha, the favorite group of Al-Qaeda. And we were like, wait, what? Because we were like at the same, we were like, yay, they said Al-Fatiha. And then we're like, wait, what? They just said Al-Qaeda. And so we were just really shocked. And it just made us, you know, made me think that the only time they think of Muslims is they think of Al-Qaeda. And they think of, they have to make a joke about it. And so just, so I think constantly battling that. And so part of, and hence the concept of coming out as Muslim. So we, when we do these workshops in queer communities, even in queer progressive communities, a lot of times, you know, we're saying that we constantly have to come out as Muslim. We constantly have to say something. We constantly have to stand up and say. And when we say it, there's a response. There's some kind of response. And so that's part of the education we do. And we also work with around, you know, trans and homophobia in mainstream Muslim communities. And, you know, it's a harder work. But it's also about building relationships. It's also about building relationships. And the way it's been successful for us is, you know, building relationships with straight Muslim allies that have an in within the community and doing work. And I think that really the promising work is with young people. I think that I keep thinking about how young people are thinking in different ways, that they are thinking about this differently. And so for us, sort of, you know, I think that there's a lot of hope in that. So there's certainly ways that we constantly simultaneously have to continue to do that work with an organization that, yes, Amrita was saying, has no staff. We do have a board, but it's very small, and it's also constantly struggling to, you know, get funding and to become a more strategic organization, but also about building those relationships as well.
I think the way we need to look at our work, and I know many of us do, but in the community, is to think or speak about all of this work, not just violence against women, but everything that's been talked about over the next 2 days, as anti-oppression work. And if we see that as the common denominator, and really use Freire's work as a basis for everything we do, I think it's even more accessible to a lot of people, right? So, because in a sense, it's not practical to be this radical organization that says, oh, the community doesn't listen to us. But you need to be where they are in order to bring them where you are.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, I think that anti-oppression has just so much more buy-in in terms of being able to speak about low-income folks, you know, all kinds of other oppressions, and you know, speak to the community in that way.
To go along with that, in terms of like doing anti-oppression work, or like, you know, carrying all those things with us wherever each of us goes. So, and I think Uruji were at this. So at one of, I have a Pride horror story as well. So at Pride 1 year, we were carrying this banner that said Desi Queers for Palestine. And it was like, it was the same day, Pride was at the same day as an anti-occupation rally. And we had a choice as to going to the anti-occupation rally or like actually changing Pride into the anti-occupation rally. Well, it didn't happen, but we did have our, you know, our posters and stuff out there. But people actually, queer people who are supposedly our community, shying away from us or being like, why do you bring that here? Like, what's that about? Things like that. Perhaps like losing allies for our issue, right? Like our South Asian queer issue. Like white queer folks are totally fine as long as you were, you know, just talking about, oh, look, we're all happy and gay together. But, you know, when it comes to taking on a larger stand, you do lose allies. So my question, actually, Manisha, is for you in terms of working with women and doing anti-violence work. When you're working with other organizations, right? Other mainstream anti-violence organizations, other women's organizations, feminist organizations, and then when you bring in a race analysis to that, right? You bring in that analysis to that conversation, then there is a potential of losing those relationships, or like there's some sort of like choice. Mm-hmm. So how do you engage with that?
They actually make a really conscious effort to get into every mainstream organization that we can. I think that in New Jersey, we are a little bit at an advantage as compared to maybe other states, in that there is enough of a progressive politic among many of the helping organizations. But Manavi, it makes a conscious effort to be in this. So all of our staff members, other than the work they do, I always, we always say that the label you have, like whether you're an outreach coordinator, a counseling coordinator, that label is just a label for funding. You still have to do, and you still must do the things that you think you want to do but are not funded, and squeeze them into your time, because sometimes those things are more important than one. Unless there's some subversive element in the way you operate, you'll never be able to do everything that you really want to do for an issue. So we definitely work along those principles, and so every staff member has picks and joins in another issue, a movement, an initiative that appeals to them and that they're interested in, and gets into that group and as a representative of Manavi. So we're everywhere in all kinds of spaces. And to, you know, as a direct response, the mainstream women's movement, whether it's anti-violence or whatever, is not happy about necessarily, or I won't say is not happy about, but doesn't really recognize, is that invisible thing. Doesn't really recognize the existence of race or immigrant status and so on. But I think that if we do get in there, we sit on committees, and then, you know, being invisible is a question of how loud you can be and sometimes obnoxious. You have to be. So I was on an executive director search committee for the NJCBW, which is the New Jersey Coalition Against for Battered Women. And they're looking for a new executive director. And they put me on the committee, I guess, to check off their box. I qualify for so many boxes, you know, the South Asian box, the colored box, the woman. And so I was there. But then having put me there, I didn't want them to think that I'm just going to come and attend their meetings and say yes and go away. I mean, or they got the wrong person, if that's what they want. They got the So I've been a very voluble presence there. So, I mean, whatever we join, whatever mainstream spaces we enter, we need to not just enter and sit quietly. We need to make our voices heard. And then, if that's a problem, then deal with it at that point and at that level. So.
My job at Advocates for Youth, Advocates for Youth is pretty mainstream in terms of really looking at reproductive and sexual rights for young people. And in that way, it really pushes the agenda. But, you know, when I've worked on the national level for the last 8 years, and in general, I feel like unless an organization is specifically addressing people of color issues, it is really challenging for folks to address communities of color issues or marginalized communities in general. And so being at Advocates for Youth, I was able to use some of my leverage to create this new program around Muslim young people. And so even though it's a very small program, it's a pilot project, I was able to advocate on behalf of the community. And so so it's really exciting. And we actually have we ended up going with a project in Queens, and we have someone from there. So maybe later Ashia can speak a little bit about it. But it's really exciting because it hasn't been done before. And as soon as I released the RFP, folks were just calling me and were just, really, there was this excitement in terms of sort of a new body of work that's out there. And so, I think the leveraging our resources and leveraging where we're at, and sometimes we are at mainstream organizations to really bring in that work as well.
Can I quickly add something more to it? Praxis International, which is largely a national body, but does some international work too for violence against women issues. It's like a really prominent national body of research and capacity building. They asked Manavi to do some consulting for them, but from there we've gone on to now become full partners with them on a certain new initiative called the Advocacy Learning Center, which will be training advocates from around the country. And now when we say around the country, we're saying rural Iowa, Oklahoma, everywhere. And by going into a full partnership with them, now we're influencing the development of the curriculum. So that's the influences from the inside instead of a fully developed learning center and curriculum, which you then go into because you're being, a box is being checked off, and then you say, oh, you know what, you should be culturally competent in these areas and those other areas. Instead of that, we're influencing the curriculum from the inside so that it's not called cultural competency. It's just called appropriate methods of advocacy and listening.
So I'm going to jump in as in probably what should be a moderator role for a second. But, I'm hearing so many different threads here, and I want to make sure that we get to, I saw some hands before, and there's a lot of expertise in this room as well, and we're throwing open some questions that I'm sure many of you have grappled with. I would love to hear strategies that you've also used. But I also want to just sum up, I think, some of this. So we're talking about what organizations who are identity-based in the South Asian community can do, right? We're also talking about what those organizations that are domestic violence organizations or queer-identified organizations, how we need to turn the same lens inward, right, and work against racism and ageism and Islamophobia, all of that within our own organizations. I also want to say, though, like I've been asked like three times since I got in last night, what organization are you with? And it's a very funny way of thinking for me. I mean, having been in movement work for 10 years, I happen to be in graduate school right now, but I think I'd like to just put out there to all of us, like, are we creating a movement or are we creating a network of nonprofit organizations, right? Because once we as individuals have these lens of analyses, regardless of where we go in life, whether we take time off to be parents or students or whatever, we have a responsibility once we have the lens of analysis to bring it to the conversation wherever we go. I mean, I'm at the Wagner School right now, and I'm working with the dean of our school to get a class on critical race theory and, I guess, anti-oppression put into our core curriculum. And it's moving forward. So we may actually have, at a national public service school, a class on this, right? I'm not doing that out of any organization. I'm doing it because this is our commitment to the work, right? So just don't buy into the game that we have to be part of some 501c3 to do this work, right? This is just a lifelong thing. And I'd like to throw it open at this point to questions that you have or things that you want to share, examples from your work, things that you've grappled with as well.
I have a question. Well, I work with Malindi actually in New Jersey as a legal coordinator. And I'm also I try to keep very in tune with what's sort of going on in New York City with different movements. And sort of the question I have is, in New Jersey, yes, we do have a very diverse areas and access to New York and other urban areas. But one thing I have noticed is that the LGBT issues that that community faces, I'm sort of wondering, like, how is that, I feel like, is that, in New York City, it seems like there's more, I don't know, resources available, or maybe an opener, more open mindset, more of a concentration in that area of groups that work with this, as opposed to New Jersey, which is a little more widespread. It is a state, and many of the populations we work with, again, are very opposed to certain ideas. And I just wanted to put the question out there, that do you what could be done in an area like New Jersey, which is slightly open but not open really? I mean, there aren't that many LGBT groups that I know of, even outside of South Asian focused or whatever. But in New York City, I do notice there's like a little bit of a wealth there. And how can we use that wealth in New York and try to apply? Because I mean, there's obviously this issue happening. I just feel like it's just not either being addressed or not even reaching out to get help.
I mean, I guess, am I the
New Yorker? I don't know. Whoever works.
I'm sure you have things to say about this as well. I can start.
Well,
from
I mean,
that,
we
know.
Can talk in house.
I mean, this is just a personal opinion. I grew up in New Jersey, and I grew up with a father who was really abusive and who, you know, battered my mom and was abusive to me for 16 years. So, and I'm queer. So, hey, I fit all these identity boxes, right? I mean, I think the first thing to realize is that queer people exist in New Jersey. And then the second thing to realize is that, you know, it's one thing to provide services. I don't think that what we're talking about is when someone calls you on the phone in crisis to say, hey, by the way, do you understand intersectionality, right? We have a need to provide services in crisis if that's what our organization stands for. But I also would challenge us to say, once women come to our organizations, if it's Manavi or domestic violence organizations, what do we do with them, right? Now there's a framework where I know at Sukhi,
We're offering English language classes, we're offering job training classes, computer classes, there's a survivor support group. Why shouldn't political education workshops be part of that work, right? Why shouldn't those women who are ready to start their healing process, to start grappling with what are they going to do next? I would say that perhaps that should be added to the organizational structure of helping women understand the links between transphobia and a hate crime against a transgendered South Asian woman, right? If we're a violence against women organization, trans women are also women. And so we should have those conversations with women who come to Manavi for help because of intimate partner violence, you know?
But how do you get them in the first place? And that's another thing, to make it comfortable where they don't feel that, wait, they're South Asian, it's great that they work with violence. And even though it says on our webpage, you know, regardless of sexuality, how do we know, you know what I mean? Like, their own fears, like, how would they...
I mean, it might be as simple as doing anti-homophobia or anti-transphobia work at, like, places of worship or community spaces. I mean, it puts you out there, and you're taking a political position, but who else is going to do it? I mean, I saw some other hands with that, so I'd love to hear other thoughts.
It seems like you have something to say to that.
Yeah. I just wanted to, I mean, that's, I want Barica, and, you know, a sister organization of Manavi, and I think for us, we've dealt with this issue a lot around serving the same-sex community, and we've kind of taken a step back. Like, we thought we have to work with the Bay Area 3CON and we have to work with the existing, and we don't. They're not responsive to us. We've opened the doors. So we need to move forward with the work that we think is important. So we make sure that we train our staff, volunteers, board on a quarterly basis on this issue. And then we also partner with mainstream LGBTQ organizations to at least, we're ready if anybody does call. And I don't think, it can't be a statistics. How many calls are we getting? It can't be. It's just, we're ready whenever that call comes. And for us too, like, we just made sure that the language is gender neutral. Mm-hmm. If somebody calls and you say, did he hit you? She's not going to respond. And also, because for us too, it's not always about same-sex relationship. It's mother-in-law hitting daughter-in-law. Mm-hmm. So it's an issue that transcends, you know, a lot. So I think it's beyond, you know, just making sure that we just have to make sure that the agency is accessible if they do call, right, and to continue that work. And regardless, we can't stop it just because in 5 years nobody's called us, or we think nobody's called us, but we don't know. We're not always checking that box. We're not always asking that question.
To zero in on exactly that point, when I think about the organization that I work for, if I was to assess whether we're ready to provide the appropriate services, I mean, maybe on a technical level, yes, we're ready, but in terms of having staff, again, you said it was a skill set, I wouldn't say that we're ready to serve that population. Can you talk a little bit more about how do we get to a point? I mean, with an organization that, again, might not have a stable staff, and also has very limited time and resources in building up a capacity that might be used very infrequently. What's the, I know there's no like silver bullet answer to this, but how does an organization need to think about developing those skill sets that might not be used that often, but still need to be there? Or are there other,
I mean, there is no easy answer, right? I think you have to look at, I mean, and time is like, I get that. You know, I've worked on the ground as well. It's always the biggest challenge, I think. We work very hard. All of us in this room, we work hard. We're here because we're dedicated to this work. But I think at some point we have to ask ourselves, like, how are we going to integrate the work? Does it mean once a month having a training, you know, that is mandatory for staff? Possibly. Does it mean building alliances with organizations? And I know that sometimes they're not responsive, and that can be frustrating. But I want to believe that we just have to keep pushing. If one door doesn't open, we can't just say, well, we tried. And, you know, and I'm not saying that you're doing that, but I just think we can't end there, you know.
And you brought up this point before, that maybe these examples or these strategies, they might not necessarily come out of, for example, the DB community. There might be other communities. Do you have advice on
The hate crimes, the anti-hate crimes community is doing really good anti-violence work. I mean, in New York, as you pointed out, we have a wealth of NGOs. Maybe we're lucky that way. But, you know, the Audre Lorde Project in New York City is a center for queer people of color citywide. And they are doing amazing anti-hate crime work, particularly against hate crimes against trans people of color, right? And so if we are in an anti-violence against women organization, I think it would behoove us to start going to actions that are, you know, against violence against trans women, right? Make sure that all of our staff and board members understand why it's an issue of violence against women. Start having those dialogues in staff meetings. Read the news and say, you know, in the beginning of a staff meeting, I want to let you all know that there was this hate crime against this woman, or there was this, you know, whatever. Make sure that you're educating your staff about even the incidences of this violence and help them start building the links in even those small ways, you know.
I just have another resource to offer. It's the API, Asian Pacific Islander, working group that specifically looks at intimate partner violence amongst GLBTQ communities. It's been around for quite a while now, maybe 8 years or so. When it first started, there was really a lack of resources, and now, you know, we've met four times every few years, and they're able to create a body of work where they're looking to expand. A lot of the folks that work in it are working in sort of, you know, ethnic and race-specific violence shelters, or doing that specific work, but then also linking it to intimate partner violence in GLBT communities, or working from the other end. So there's definitely some resources. So if you all are interested, let me know, and I can, you know, and the folks are from all over the country that are working.
Can I quickly add that I think that the most successful training is not a training that compartmentalizes these oppressions to say, let me come today and tell you all there is to know about LGBT people. Because when we do our cultural competency trainings, we go in and say, this is not a primer on South Asia, because we couldn't do it in 5 days if we tried, right? So I think any of these trainings need to have a flavor of anti-oppression work. You know, when we're saying this is a training about if a queer person calls you, how do you deal with it? But it's also a training about why it is that we are giving this training. It's because queer people are oppressed. It's because women are oppressed. It's because South Asian immigrant women who are battered are oppressed. And so unless we keep that common denominator, these trainings otherwise just become, you know.
Other questions? Hi. I work at South Asian Youth Action in New York. And I'm a fundraiser, so I don't work with the youth directly. But when they had their workshop on homophobia, I came out to them as a gay man and talked to them about my experience, and that was really powerful. So I guess to any queer organization in the room or people individually, I think that there is such power to just sharing one's personal story and seeing that change happen, because I'm there every day. So, you know, they talk to me, you know, like we interact normally, but they know who I am. So I think that that's a really powerful opportunity that I think that maybe the Solgas and the Dracones of the world could do in partnership with, you know, their youth organizations, but also with their adult-serving organizations, like other organizations that work with adults, you know, incorporating that element into their work more. So I just wanted to share that, because that was extremely powerful for me, and I got a lot of benefit out of it, and I hope that the youth did too. And then I know there's only a few minutes left, but I wanted to talk about men for a second. The fact that, you know, I've been hearing a lot about violence against women and the LGBTIQ community. And just wondering, is there a conversation happening about issues facing men? You know, not necessarily just queer men, but men, period. Because I think that it's in tune with what's happening in the mainstream world, right? I mean, there's been such a glut of focus on women's causes and girls' empowerment. You know, SIA has a girls' empowerment program. But we have a whole crew of boys who have no role models because, you know, many of our organizations are dominated by female employees, which is great. You know, I have no issues with that. But it's just that, you know, it just is. And these are, you know, pretty much lost boys who don't have the role models. We seek volunteers to work with them. So is there a conversation happening on the industry level when it comes to men and boys?
So definitely in the, I work in reproductive rights community, and definitely there's a conversation that's happening. Even at Advocates for Youth, we're trying to develop a program. And then there's also this, so in the terms of the LGBT community, we know that the HIV epidemic is hugely disproportionate in young men of color community. So there's one piece to address as a reproductive rights piece, as a information piece, and creating, we're looking at structural barriers, looking at what neighborhoods these, there's a lot of structural barriers that a lot of these communities face in terms of overlap of poverty and, immigration, and all of those things that are affecting the epidemic. And then also we're looking at working with, straight young men in terms of male, responsibility, in terms of how do you so it's sort of different because we're not necessarily saying that, challenge gender roles, but then also, what it means to be a man and what it means to have male responsibility. So we're trying to do some of the work, but it is true that, a lot of times it's, there's a lack of funding or, lack of resources. And so, but definitely I've been hearing in the field that people want to work with men and want to make sure that that's part of the equation as also working with young women.
Hi, I'm Prashant from Tripura Northwest in Seattle. So my question is about the, I've heard this is something that happens, both in domestic violence organizations, LGBT groups, but one of the core issues is reaching out to the people that, need the help the most. So what I've seen with Circle Northwest, I was with Push DC also for a while, is that when we do have events and we try to reach out, we're reaching out to the same folks over and over again who, it's great, that they have the space, but I see the value of these organizations in reaching out to those, you mentioned that they're located in New Jersey, but either they don't know or they know and they're too scared to come out or whatever it is. So one common theme I've heard is these hotlines or emails. I'm curious to know how effective are those? Like, have you used, when you've used a hotline or this anonymous email, how, do people actually call in or how often does it happen or what else can be done in addition to these, to reach out to the folks that really need the help?
I would just use Al-Fatih as a framework because, again, the queer Muslim community is very isolated, even in major urban areas. Part of it is fear and stigma. A lot of it is fear and stigma, and even they have a lot of fear coming into spaces. So the way we do it is, like I said, we have this huge listserv, but then we also have regional listservs. So a lot of times when we're organizing, we'll send out emails that way, but then we also about local relationship building. So we might, we build relationship with folks that are locally situated who might know other people. And, even in DC, we've been able to create a space where, folks will show up. We might have an event around 10 to 15 people. And for a queer Muslim event, it's a big gathering, but definitely making sure that people don't feel, that their fear and stigma is a little bit, sort of addressed. So, for example, we don't announce the events. Even if for a big conference, we don't announce where it's going to be because we realize that that's an issue. So that's a community that, is definitely has a lot of fear. So that's just an example of how, we've done work with Al-Fatih in that respect.
I just wanted to say it's 1 o'clock and we're going till 1:05. So, and we have lunch right after this. So folks who feel like they want to stay back and, continue the conversation, please feel free to do so. Yes, the hand in the back. Red, yeah.
I'm going to keep it short because I could talk for a long time. So I'm going to try to keep it short. But, Aruj, I just want to say I'm so excited about your organization. It's my first time hearing about it. So I just want to put that out there. I'm so excited about this being Muslim. I'm really excited. But, big words have been thrown around, like intersectionality, anti-oppression. And it's like, I feel like day-to-day in organizations, the whole thing of power and privilege is so huge, right? Because some of the most abusive behavior I've seen as a community organizer is in domestic violence and in immigrant rights work, So it's just interesting. Like, even myself, I come from a working class background, so many times I've attacked people. Like, what? I'm working class, when I was younger, obviously. I'm better now. But anyway, the example you gave, Amita, of working with the youth and the whole thing of, not coming out at first. Because, I feel like when I thought about what you said, not using your power and privilege to say, hey, I'm queer. Mm-hmm. So now you cannot talk about queer folks. Because I feel like then it's like, oh, I'm homophobic, and I'm not going to tell her because she might just fail me in the class, right? And I was thinking about that because over time you build this trust. Mm-hmm. And then they were able to challenge their own homophobia, you know? And I feel like constantly, so what I'm saying is just kind of simplifying like how important smaller words like power and privilege and like building trust, how important they are for us to constantly do that. And that allows us to build power within our organizations, or even if we're not an organization, if I work in a barbershop, you know what I mean? How I do that and then collaborate with other organizations. You know, like Uruj, when you talked about the example, like of collaborating with like other queer organizations at the same time trying to collaborate with other Muslim organizations, right? And looking at that intersectionality, right? And how you do it in a way where you're not attacking people, but actually building. So anyway, thanks for that.
Thank you. I'll keep it very brief. I just wanted to speak to the people that had made sort of comments about how it's been difficult to penetrate the GLBT community with issues of domestic violence and to really build connections and to, you know, people that are finding themselves without a response. And I just wanted to say, I mean, my name is Bijal, and I'm a recent transplant to D.C., and I've been working with the Kush board, or I guess on the Kush board, representing the female voice as well as the second-generation diaspora perspective. And there's a lot of fractionality within these organizations as well, and I just want to urge people to know that there are people who advocate for the work that you're doing within those organizations, and that if you could just keep, you know, reaching out, keep coming to these events, keep speaking up, you'll find that you have people who may not have sort of the weight of or numbers within the organization to push for these issues or to push to work on these issues, but would really appreciate being able to use your, you know, your strengths and your perspective to help push to work on those issues in those organizations.
Thanks,
Bijal.
I also thank you so much for saying that, because I also wanted to address the issue that you had brought up about capacity, because I think sometimes that's used, especially now when money, like none of us have any money to do anything, you know, like issues like this get swept under, and I think what Manisha said is putting it under the umbrella of anti-oppression. Like, it has to be a part of the core values of the organization, and it transcends all of us. We aren't going to advocates come and go, but it has to be about the value of the organization, and I think only then can we see it change. And even like with the Tricon and stuff that we've worked with, like it's again a constant, because the boards change, the volunteers change, the ideology changes, like it has to just be ongoing. And it's just embedded in who the organization is. I think that's really critical.
I just wanted to add, in terms of the funding, there is a foundation called the Paul Rappaport Foundation that is looking to fund LGBT Asian-related work. They're trying to get into it. So there's a lead.
What's the name again?
The Paul Rappaport Foundation. You know, if they get a flood after this weekend, they'll know who to talk to.
Fabio told us.
Well, I wouldn't say that. But... No, I mean, it should be helpful, and there is funding available. The Stonewall Community Foundation in New York just put out an RFP specifically to help queer communities of color. So,
are there any other questions at this point? Well, to wrap up, I know we're right at 1:05. I actually just wanted to ask each of the panelists to give us like a brief, quick, like throughout to the future. Like, you know, where do you see us going? What's your vision coming forward?
Okay. Real quick, I would just say we're all here. You know, if we think back to those of you who were at last night's reception, Deepa framed this conference and gathering as South Asians who are working for social justice. And just to build on what you said, I mean, whatever organization you're a part of, make that commitment to speak up as a board member, a staff member, a volunteer, a member of the organization, to really make sure your organization is accountable for anti-oppression work across the board, right? And don't stop talking about it.
Yeah, I would just echo what Amita also said. Just look at the anti-oppression, connect with other, you know, communities of color, do the broader framework of work, look at the broader framework, and also look at structural barriers that folks are facing to even access services.
Absolutely on board with the same thing. Anti-oppression work is the way to reach all sorts of identity lines, and whatever it is you're doing, if you relate it to anti-oppression work, and that will help you bring other issues into your work, so it's not pigeonholed and narrow and just about one thing, but recognize that there are so many other things going on within what you're working on. So overarching themes are what make all of this work possible.
All right, thank you so much to all our panelists. Thank you all for being here.